material in getting an overview of the special education system in our state. And we're getting a lot of information, and we've asked for follow-up information on a number of topics as well. And at some point, we're going to have to figure out as a working group how we want to discuss the information that we got. I mean, sort of like the survey course, but then we need to digest it, discuss it, figure out what we want to do with it, figure out if there's more follow-up that we need to do. Because, again, the purpose of this working group is to do a deep dive and a careful investigation and work through these issues in a meaningful way so that we can figure out what, if anything, we should be doing to improve special education in our state. And so I don't think it's we don't think it's enough to merely hear folks present, but we need to discuss it and figure out where to go and help set the direction for future meetings and the like. So that's something that I think we're going to want to have a meeting of just a group with no presenters at some point to discuss, and probably sooner rather than later so that we can move forward in an appropriate way. That being said, is there anyone else like to make a comment, co-chairs? No? Okay, the next item on the agenda is the approval of the prior meeting minutes. I'm going to start because I've got a number of comments and requests for our minute takers. First of all, on the first page, it's not the meeting agenda, but in fact the minutes from our last meeting. And I think it also would be helpful if we could have page numbers so that it would make it easier to refer to points that we need to correct as we go through it. And with that said, at the bottom of what is page 2, not labeled that way, but is, at the very bottom in the last paragraph, I believe, and you know, don't let me get away with this, so double-check the record, but I believe that what I stated was that we would like to have DDS come back because a lot of the information was presented in a very short time, as is stated here, but it was, and it was very difficult to follow without accompanying written material, and that made it difficult on members of the working group who were trying to follow what was being stated. So I think that's a critical point to make, because we want them to come back with material that we can follow. On to the next page. Just a question in the middle paragraph there when it says, this is referring to Ms. Marchion, where she said that BRS is required by federal law to know who will provide this ongoing support. I'm not sure if it was who will provide or who will need it. I just think we should check the record on that to see what, in fact, she said. There are also a number of places in here where we asked for follow-up information, and I think it would be useful to the working group to perhaps create a list, bullet points, or chart, or some form of all of the requested information when we requested at a meeting, and then to see what we actually have, in fact, received, and what is still outstanding, and any problems we may be having in getting follow-up information, just so that we can track it better. So I'd ask David if you would put something together along those lines, and then we can, rather than asking you repeatedly, have we received this throughout this, we'll have a chart or something that will indicate to us what we have gotten and what is still outstanding. And then, of course, you should let us know if we need to help you in any way to get that information. And that, let me see here. And then just on page 5 in the, I guess, fourth paragraph in, the first major paragraph there, on the 1, 2, 3, fourth line down, there's a typo. There, the number 4 crept into the word because. On the next page, in the first full paragraph, in the third line of that, there should be an article A between have and job. So have a job they could stay in. 1, 2, 3 paragraphs below that, in the fourth line, there's an extra word in there. It should be SDE has no data, and instead it has have, so the have should come out. Skipping 1, 2, 3 paragraphs below that, in the second line, I believe there's a huge gulf as opposed to a hug gulf, but a hug gulf sounds interesting, and maybe we should look into that. And then later on in that paragraph, it says should examine outcome data 2 in order to, so I guess it's get rid of that first 2 and stick with in order to, and I would say instead of ascertain that, I would say see if the state needs to do a better job in providing services. So those would be my recommended changes there. And then on the next page in the second full paragraph, I believe Attorney Klebanoff asked if there was a standard to determine, so the word asked should be inserted. And finally, on the last page, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs down, Attorney Klebanoff asked if he could, and I think we could delete the I file documentation. So those are the things that I saw and would ask to have corrected in the minutes. I don't know if anyone else has any other comments. And sorry to take so long. There was some extra difficulty in preparing the minutes this time, so I'd like to let everyone know that, because we had some problems with the recording of the last meeting and in being able to translate that transcribe that. And so that led to the extra difficulties that we've had, because normally our minutes are quite good, and I want to commend our staff overall on that. But that this time there were particular issues that created havoc for them. So I think given what they went through, this is still a very good job, but we need to make those corrections. All right, so with that and seeing no other comments, why don't we
make a motion to approve the minutes as amended.
I wasn't here.
Oh, right. Second on that? Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we're good on the minutes. Do you have a? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Why don't you, Representative Cook?
Good morning. We were joined by another member. If you would like to just add your name to the record, so we know that you are present.
Kimberly Planis, Director of People Personnel for Hampton Public Schools.
Thank you. Also, so you all know as well that the written copies of the SDE slideshow are coming. David, they are in.
They are being printed as we speak.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, I wanted to also, on a brief note, thank everybody who reached out to me with condolences for the loss of my mother-in-law, and that was why I was not able to be here at the last meeting. So thank you all for that. It meant a lot. So, and thanks for understanding. And you wanted to go where? Terry?
Just a quick statement, right. Just to let you know, this is the time of year where we're lucky if we only need to be in two places at once. That's easy for us to handle by comparison to some of the days. And so some of us may have to bounce out of here. There's voting taking place in other committees throughout the building. So just wanted to make people aware of that. It's not that we're not interested. It's that we may be called somewhere else. In fact, I've tried to arrange it so I don't have to and can cast all of my votes afterwards, so I'm going to try to stay, but no promises, and others are working on it. All right, so with that, why don't we move into our first presenter here, which is item number 4, a presentation on a primer on approved and non-approved private special education providers in Connecticut, which is going to be given by Colleen Hills of the State Department of Education. And Colleen, we really appreciate you coming here. We know you had to rearrange a previously set off-site visit to come here instead, but we really appreciate that because we do want the person most knowledgeable from the State Department to educate us on this topic. So thank you for being here this morning.
Colleen, before you get started, Kim, you want to shut your mic off? And then for the members, I know we're in a different, you know, setting and environment, and we're not seeing each other, and you know, we promise not to throw things at your back unless you misbehave. But if there's a question that you might have, since we won't be able to necessarily see you eye to eye, if you can just lift your hand or turn around and give us a nod. We apologize. We didn't want to cancel the meeting, and this was the only hearing room that we could have. And although it is a glorious hearing room, it is a little odd to not be in the round. So with that, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to come and share information and clarifying issues that may come up and answer any questions you may have. I basically am beginning my presentation today based on a slide that was shared with you previously by one of my colleagues, Maria Zanotti, and understood that my role was really to move forward from this slide in explaining a little bit more about the approval process and what makes an approved private special education program. Just a note that while there are over 4,000 students that are outplaced across the state, At just about a little over half of those students are placed in approved private special education programs. So the other half of the students are placed in the programs that are listed here, RESCs, Homebound, other non-public schools, out-of-state, USD2.
You said 4,000?
I believe that was the...
4,000 are placed out of district, and half of those... Yeah.
Yes. This is based on the numbers that Maria Zanotti shared with you during her presentation, that at the last count, and I think this represents the October 1st count, and understand that this number changes daily because students are placed...
Right, but it's a rough approximation.
Right.
It's close enough for
correct
our purposes.
Yes. And I think the exact number that the most recent number I have is that 2,518 of those 4,739 are in approved private special education programs.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's what I wanted the clarification on.
Right. The programs to which I am speaking today. All right. I thought it would be helpful just to remind everybody what the role of an approved private special education program is in the state of Connecticut. And basically, its role is to provide the appropriate services and supports to students that require special education when a school district is not able to meet those requirements and their obligation under state statute and federal law. So the role of the approved private special education program is not to develop the individual educational program for the student. It's really to implement the individualized educational program, or IEP, that's developed through the school district via the PPT, the Planning and Placement Team Meeting. So it's kind of a matter of ownership. The students still belong to the school district, and they're still reported as students within the school district. The public school systems are basically contracting out these services and through the private schools. What makes an approved private special education program different from another private special education program or private school in the state is that these programs must meet the standards and the approval principles which have been set forth through the Board of Education. And that document is available to you on our website. And it lists what the expectations are, it lists the standards and the policies and procedures that private schools need to adhere to. The schools must meet the prerequisites for the application, and I will get into that in a minute. They then must submit an application to us. The application is about a little over 30 pages long. However, the completion of that application usually results in a binder that's anywhere from 6 to 12 inches deep. The programs must also participate in the approval process, which includes 2-day-long visits. They must then provide and implement policies and procedures which will ensure that they're in compliance with all the Connecticut state statutes and any other federal laws, as well as their own local regulations.
Can I stop you really quick? Thank you. The information that you're giving us on the slideshow, is that the information that we're getting in hard copy?
Mm-hmm.
Also, you had said that something was on the website.
Yes.
Is that also going to be in your packet?
No, the link to it would be there, but it's on the State Department website. I mean, it's a document in and of itself.
Right. Can we send that too as well? Because I find that when we're having somebody come in to give us the information, instead of us going to dig around and search for it, it's easy to have it right here in front of us so we can ask you questions if we need to ask you questions in regards to everything that you're you're testifying, you know, towards.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, I had sent this forward for the last meeting when we got canceled for snow, and assumed that it had gotten to you, that the slide presentation had gotten to you. I do have a copy of, you know, I only brought one because it's quite lengthy, but if people want to pass this around, it's a copy of the actual application, so you can take a look at that. The other thing that the approval process requires is that if there are any identified standard deficiencies, in other words, if the program does not meet any of the policies, procedures, or standards within that application, the programs have to agree to correct any of those standards deficiencies. So, purpose of the approval process, again, is for us to go in and evaluate the suitability and efficacy of programs prior to those programs assuming their role in implementing the IEPs for public school LEAs. We also verify that the programs are meeting the policies and procedures and standards that are in that linked document that have been approved by the State Board of Education. I will kind of provide a caveat. That document, I believe, was produced back in the late 90s and is currently under revision, and I'm hoping to have that complete very soon. The problem is every time I think I've got it all the revisions in there, something changes, and I'm trying to make it as up-to-date as possible. So, but also know that any federal or state regulations that have occurred since that document was produced are still a requirement of the approved private special education programs. We provide them with updates to legislation, to regulations that they have to meet each year. So, as I noted before, there are some prerequisites before a school is able to even submit the application to us. So, any program that's seeking approval, and programs come to us to seek approval. We don't go and solicit programs to become approved private schools, just to clarify. So the first thing, that they have to be in operation for at least a year. That gives us some information that there's some fiscal stability with the program, and they also must have an enrollment of at least 10 students. And again, they must make the request to us to seek the consideration of approval and submit the application to us. Now, the application itself, which is going around, it actually reflects all those standards in that document that was linked to the other slide. And the standards that are included address governance, which speaks to the governing board and the chief administrator of the program. Administration of the program. Let me just catch up here. And that really talks about, that piece is really about the policies and procedures that are required and that the programs need to make available to LEAs upon request. The next piece, addresses fiscal management. And again, what we're looking for with this is that the program demonstrates a maintenance of an accounting system, that they provide the most recent annual audit, and they demonstrate that they have the appropriate insurance covering liability, workman's comp, and those kinds of things. The next standard is around admissions, that their admissions policies follow the procedures and standards of approved private schools. The next piece addresses individual student records. As I said before, the approved private school, their role is to implement the IEP, but while the student is enrolled in their program, they need to maintain an updated and current student record. So we go in and we do a file review on each of the students when we do the initial approval and then when we do the reapprovals. And we look to see that the private schools are maintaining the appropriate information in the student file. Program requirements. This section really speaks to what is required in terms of 180 days of school, providing 900 hours of instruction, similar to a public school. We look to see if their curriculum is in line with the Common Core standards. We look at transportation, if they provide transportation, and if they do, that they have the appropriately licensed drivers as well as vehicles. We look to make sure that the programs are complying with the requirements under IDEA and state regulations around progress reports that are provided to parents and to the school districts as well, as determined and as outlined in their IEP. Student management techniques speaks to what behavior, I'm wiping the word behavior management out of my lexicon and starting to use behavior intervention program, but what positive behavioral supports are in place, what their behavior intervention program, since many of our programs deal with students whose behavior is what is impeding their ability to be instructed in the public school. We look to ensure that they've got some positive behavioral support systems built in. Many of our schools have school-wide management systems that are unique to their programs. And then in addition to that, we look at the students' IEPs to ensure that if a student needs more than that, that, you know, there's documentation that a functional behavioral assessment has been conducted and that the student has a behavior intervention plan. And then we ensure that all the instructional and administrative personnel in the approved private schools are appropriately certified for the students that they serve. So administrators have to hold the same administrative certification that a public school administrator would have to hold in terms of an 092 or an 093 for the ed director position. They also have to hold, they have to be duly certified, they have to hold that certification as well as a certification in comprehensive special education and or related services. And obviously teachers need to hold the appropriate certification as well. Most of the programs have teachers that hold comprehensive special education certification. Many of our programs and more of them are employing people that actually have dual certification, that have general ed certification, that have subject area certification, as well as special education certification. And we encourage that mix, even especially with our high school programs that service our high school students, to ensure that those students are getting the instruction from the appropriately certified content area teachers. And then finally, we also look at health and safety. Are they following the appropriate medication, administration policies? Do they have people trained appropriately? Do they have smoking policies? Do they have a monthly record of emergency and fire drills? I recently, probably the last piece of legislation that came out around this that I shared with most of the private schools were any, for example, that provide, they have a swimming pool or provide swimming instruction. So any of the regulations that have come out for the public schools are basically shared with the private schools. And if it applies, it needs to apply to their program. And finally, there's a standard around termination of enrollment, which really speaks to if a program finds that they have accepted a student whose needs are beyond what they can provide for that student, which would be a non-crisis situation. So we have policies and procedures in terms of how that student would be terminated from the program, and it would involve a whole process where the LEA is involved and there's time taken to make further plans, future plans for the student, as well as the parents. And then there's a policy around what can be done in a crisis situation as well. Now the process, as I said, the programs request an application. We provide consultation throughout the process. You know, I'm often answering calls as programs, new programs are completing this application for the first time. There's a lot of back and forth conversation and clarification for the programs and in assisting them in completing that application. The program submits the application to us, and then we review and evaluate the application. Site visits are conducted. And as I said before, there are two site visits involved in the approval process. The first day is the day that an SDE consultant from the Bureau of Special Education goes out and meets individually with the education director and or the chief administrator of the program. And during that day, we spend the morning going over the application page by page. For the program to provide clarification. They may have to provide further documentation. We may have questions about their responses to some of the pieces of the application. During that day, we also conduct the student file reviews and staff file reviews to ensure, again, that we've got the appropriate requirements around fingerprinting prior to hiring. You know, were there references provided by the applicant before the program accepted this person as an employee. So there are a number of things that we look at. We also look at their emergency drill records that day, up to the point where we are now collecting. We still look at their compilation of restraint and seclusion data, although as we move into our new data collection system on restraint and seclusion, we're hoping that we're not going to duplicate that piece because we have access to that information on an ongoing basis now. So those are some of the things that we look at on day one. Day two is a team visit, and that team is comprised of, again, the representative from the State Department of Ed, a representative, an education director from another approved private special education program, and a representative from a local education agency. Typically, it's the director of special education services, a pupil personnel director, again, another administrator that holds an 092. And this is probably repetitive, but these are the kinds of things, again, that if I was doing an approval, I would go in and look at on day one. And then we also plan the day two visit. It's at this point that really our purpose is to verify that the program is fully implementing IEPs for the enrolled students in their program. What happens on that second day is the team, we have a schedule of classroom observations that are usually followed up by interviews with the classroom teacher. And we also use an IEP to reference as we're doing the observations, again, to help ensure and verify that that IEP is somehow being addressed within the program. We review the curriculum and behavior intervention policies and any other systems that the program might have in place. And then the final piece is an exit conference. And basically by the end of that second day, we have a pretty good idea of what the program, what program improvements need to be made, if there are standard deficiencies based on the standards and the requirements, what they are, and we share that with the administration of the program, as well as identifying for them any commendations or strengths of the program. So we really come up with the strengths, the weaknesses, where things need to be improved, and then also what things have to be changed and have to be done in order for the program to access that approval status. Following the visits, we produce a preliminary evaluation report. And again, you know, the way it's set up is we provide the program with commendations, the standard deficiencies, and the required corrective action. If there is a deficiency identified, there is a required corrective action attached to that with a date and the specifics of what they have to provide to SDE. And the final part of that is the recommendations piece. These are recommendations that the team has come up with that would serve to improve the program, but are in no way required for the program to complete in order to maintain an approval. And the programs get that report, and they have to attest to agreement to those corrective actions. They have to put in writing that they have read and they agree with the findings of the report, and that's basically what triggers the recommendation from our bureau to the commissioner to approve a private special education program. Again, there are three possible dispositions of this process. The first is a program can be approved. All new programs are only approved for 1 year, and we go back in a year later and do the exact same process all over again. They have to provide us with a brand new application, and the process is replicated a year later. Any other program that has already been in existence, when we go back in, that program can be approved for anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And I often get the question, well, what makes a 3-year approval versus a 5-year approval? Sometimes it's around the type, not necessarily the number of standard deficiencies, but the types of standard deficiencies that are identified. Sometimes it may be because a program has identified that they're going to be moving to a new site within 2 years. So we would want to go back and look at a site within 3 years and maybe not wait 5 years. It could depend on, you know, if we've gotten many inquiries or there have been complaints around a private school. We may look at that program and say, well, yes, they meet all the standards, but we don't want to go 5 years in terms of waiting to do a reapproval. So it really depends. I tried at one time to change that so that the cycles were a little bit more even for those of us at the Bureau that have to conduct these visits, because I can have anywhere from 8 to 18 visits a year to conduct the way the cycle is right now. But I have not yet accomplished that feat so that it works out, that they're more evenly spaced out. The other status that a program may hold is a conditional approval. All new programs are basically conditional approvals. But if we go into a program that's been in existence and, again, we find that there are serious standard deficiencies and things that need to be corrected, sooner than later, we will give a program a conditional approval, which again means that we go back in a year later to ensure that they have met the corrective actions. The other possibility is that the program is not approved because they don't meet the standards. In between approval cycles, annually, all of the approved private schools have to submit a signed statement of assurance that each program has to document that they maintain basically the standards that they had to adhere to when they put in their first application. So they have to make sure that they comply with all state and federal regulations. They have to have that annual audit report that would be available to the local school district or the State Department upon request. They have to demonstrate to us that they are still maintaining adequate insurance, both fire and general liability. They basically attest us that each of their enrolled students that are enrolled by the local education agency or a district is fully implemented, and that their curriculum is still in line with the Common Core standards. And they ensure that their school year and instructional hours have not changed, and that they're commensurate with the hours that a public school student is required to attend school. They have to assure us that they are continuing to provide for the conducting the and the administration of the statewide assessments. The application that's going around talks about CMT and CAPT. And again, this year we're doing CMT and CAPT as well as Smarter Balance. Districts have a choice, and much to the dismay of the private schools, I'm sure, it puts the private schools in a position that they may have to do both CMT and CAPT and Smarter Balance, depending on the district that their student is placed by. So most of our private schools will be administering both assessments this year. Again, they have to attest that they are maintaining appropriately certified administrative and instructional staff, that they have a professional development plan which follows the regulations for all public schools, a minimum of 18 hours of professional development for their staff. And they have to ensure that their policies and procedures, as I said, are updated each year so that they reflect any changes in legislation or regulations. The other requirements, and these are some of the things that you will find that a private school that is not approved are not required to do. Aside from what I've already covered, the approved private special education programs have mandatory data collections and reports to the state similar to what the public schools have. So they have to provide data regarding their staff file, the teacher course student data collection, their restraint and seclusion data, their membership and attendance data, and all of their discipline data. So they report data reports similar to what the public schools do. In addition to that, teachers and administrators that are employed by approved private special education programs will have to adhere to the required educator evaluation guidelines or hopefully adaptations to SEET. They also have a process for if they have a change in their program, and that could be anywhere from the number of students they want to enroll to the ages of students that they serve, to the disability category of students they are servicing. But if they have changing of location, in between approval cycles, there's also a process that they go through to request approval of that program change, and that requires consultation. It sometimes requires an additional site visit as well. They also have some notification requirements, you know, should there be any legal proceedings, reports of child abuse, anything that significantly would impact the program, they have a requirement to provide that information to SDE. Now, I'm not, I have to say that I am not familiar, and I don't have the experience or expertise to comment beyond these two slides that I prepared around what are called approved non-public schools, which are different than approved private special education programs. This is a much broader group of schools that includes anywhere from your parochial schools to other private special education programs to your prep schools. So this is a list that's held by SDE, and it's my understanding that a school can request to be included on this list if they meet these criteria. And basically, that means they have to have an accreditation by another agency that's approved by SDE, and that would include the American Association of Christian Schools, the Association of Christian Schools International, the Connecticut Association of Independent Schools, and the New England Association of Schools and Colleges. They also have to provide, I understand, current clearance by fire and health authorities. They have to provide an annual attendance report, an ED 159. And basically what this approval allows the non-public school to do is offer its own diploma. Most of our approved private schools cannot provide an individual diploma to students. The diploma that's provided comes from the sending school district, or the LEA. I think out of our current list of about 58 private schools, I believe there are four or five that hold a dual, they're on both lists. In other words, they're an approved private special education program. They're also on the approved non-public school list. And therefore, students that are enrolled in their program can receive a diploma if they're placed by the public school from the LEA, or the program could provide their own diploma. Otherwise, for the remainder majority of our approved private special education programs, the diplomas for students, if they graduate from there, come from their public school system. The other thing that makes an approved private special ed program different from a non-approved public school is that, in general, an LEA can submit an excess cost grant if the cost of a student's program meets the identified cost threshold. There are some exceptions to that and very specific circumstances that an LEA might be able to access their excess cost or state agency placement grant if they place a student in a non-public school that's not approved by as an approved private special education. But generally speaking, programs seek this approval so that districts can, number one, feel comfortable that there is an approval process, that all of their staff is appropriately certified, and that these facilities, these programs, meet the requirements of both state and federal regulations. In addition to that, if the cost might to educate that student does exceed the threshold around their per pupil cost, they may also access the excess cost grant. So these are just other resources that I provided links to that you might be interested in and have been referenced in the presentation.
Great. Thank you very much for the presentation. Appreciate the I guess the bureaucratic background of what's required in special ed. There are some things I would love to know. Are there private, how do you define a special education private school? Was it in here? Did I miss it? How is that defined? As opposed to a private school.
Well, the special education private schools are schools that have the staffing and the capacity to address the needs of a student with a disability that has an individual educational plan developed by a school district. In other words, part of their admission standards is that that school has to, when they get that IEP upon referral, the private school, in this case the approved special ed school, has to review that document and ensure to the district that they can provide what's written in that document as the appropriate program for that student. And that IEP would include all of their supports and services. So while you may have a private school that provides, a small class setting, and maybe they have individual tutoring available, that may not meet the needs of that would not typically meet the needs of a student who has an IEP that has specialized instruction written into it, that has the requirement for a special education teacher to provide that specialized instruction.
Okay, got it.
And or may require related services that these programs have available to them, which ranges from speech and language.
So private day schools, smaller settings, even if they have special tutors for language-related learning
right.
disabilities, may not be. So
correct.
What I'll do, without further questions on this, I'll just look at the approved list and then maybe get to you offline on this.
Okay.
Another question, you mentioned behavioral intervention plan as part of the reviewed IEP every year. And I guess I think a number of us are interested. I think a lot of behavior issues stem from a student not being in the right educational environment. So how is that defined? How much is true social emotional behavioral issues or just not the appropriate educational setting?
Well, I think and probably when you hear Pat's presentation later, what you'll find is that oftentimes when there is an appropriate placement made for a student, the behavioral issues may be minimized. But for the most part, the students that districts refer to these special education facilities, the hope and the expectation is that the district has already exhausted all possibilities, looked at other types of classroom settings, looked at other types of services that might address those needs, and those haven't been enough for this student in particular. So they're looking elsewhere for those kinds of settings and also programs that can be more focused on providing behavior interventions that maybe the public school cannot provide.
Thank you. Do you have an approximate breakout of how many students are in approved private special education programs, specifically, for example, learning language-related learning disabilities versus social emotional behavioral issues?
I don't have
a number. Is there any tracking on that?
I don't have a number offhand, and I would have to think about whether or not the data collection through our CDAC data collection would identify that information. But I can tell you that, generally speaking, many of our students are placed due to behavioral, social, emotional, and behavioral issues.
So that's most of the three-quarters of the placement?
I can think of, I probably have to go through the list myself, but I could think of five or six programs offhand who specialize in specialized instruction for students with identified significant learning disabilities that may not be addressing the social, emotional, behavioral piece like some of our more specialized treatment center programs would be. So again, we do provide that directory on our website that gives kind of an outline of each of the programs and a summary that the programs have provided us in terms of describing their programs and the population that they serve and the needs of the students.
Thank you. And one last question. Are any of these approved private special education programs out of state?
We do not, no. We do not approve out of state programs. That does not prohibit a school district from placing a student in an out-of-state program.
But it would prohibit the excess cost grant application.
It could. They may be able to access that. It depends on the the school district has to do their due diligence in looking to see if that program has gone through a comparable process of approval in another state. And they also have to do their due diligence that there is no other program within the state of Connecticut that could meet the needs of this student. And then they may be able to request access to the excess cost grant.
Okay, thank you. I actually do have one more question on back to the language, what I call for maybe not a good definition, but garden variety learning disability, where it's strictly a learning disability. It's not a social behavioral, social emotional behavioral issue. Dyslexia, for example, why more districts don't internalize a good program?
Well, I think that's why what we see is we see fewer of those types of specialized approved private programs. And, you know, the fact is that in many cases, districts can address those issues through their in-district programs. But I think there are cases where, again, they've exhausted all of the resources in-district, and there's a need to look at a very specialized approach for those students. And that's why there are some programs that are out there who have sought approval from us. Again, we don't go out and advertise, come get approved. These are programs that have, again, taken it upon themselves to seek approval for their purposes of enrolling students placed by LEAs.
Great. Thank you very much. And again, thank you for being here in your presentation.
Good morning again. Thank you for your presentation. I've got several questions before we start opening up to other committee members. How much money are we spending on the 6.8% of students who are in these settings versus other special education settings? Do you know?
I would not be able to answer that question. I'm an education consultant, not in the financial piece of the department.
Okay, so you wouldn't know about the rate setting either and how that's done, because
I think Kevin Chambers would probably be the best person. I mean, I have some general knowledge, but I could not answer specific. I wouldn't be comfortable answering specific questions.
Could you tell us how many approved schools there are right now?
I believe at last count, I counted 58, although Pat said she counted 49. And again,
somewhere in that range?
Yes.
Okay.
Some programs have multiple sites, which confuses the numbers of actual programs.
Got it. Okay. So I'm curious, you went through the prerequisites to be able to submit an application, and among those was that the school be in operation for at least a year and have at least 10 students.
Correct.
So at the time, they are non-approved schools, correct? And I'm curious to know, does the state reimburse school districts for putting students in non-approved schools as well as approved schools?
Again, that's only under certain conditions, and that, again, would be based on, I think Kevin could probably answer those questions better, but there are a limited number of certain conditions that, you know, a district may be able to access their excess cost grant in a non-approved setting. You know, hearing decisions, mediated agreements, I mean, there are probably, from what I understand, there are probably 7 or 8 exceptions to that, where that could a district could access their excess cost grant. But again, I'd be more comfortable if I don't deal with that part of the approved private special education. This is really a programmatic piece that I deal with.
Okay, I mean,
as opposed to the financial piece.
Just sitting here and someone who's not an expert in this at all, but in listening, it doesn't feel right that we have children in non-approved schools. You'd like to think that they've all been vetted and properly done. So I'm not sure why we have to have at least 10 students there and for at least a year before a school can come and get the approvals of the state. I'm not sure. It doesn't feel right that
students would not necessarily be placed there by school districts. They may be unilaterally placed there by parents. So what I find is that in most cases, before a school seeks approval, they will have a population of students that's comprised of students that are placed there by their parents, similar to if I wanted to place my son or daughter at Choate. They also have students who may be placed there by virtue of a mediated agreement or a settlement agreement. In other words, an agreement that's made by a school district with parents. On rare occasion, a state agency, there may be that involvement, but that's a pretty rare case that a state agency would be involved in, such as DCF, in placing a student in a residential program that had a non-approved educational program, but that can happen.
Okay, and then you, in talking about the approval process, you said that among the things that these schools have to do is accept and correct all identified standard deficiencies.
Correct.
And so I'm curious, because then once they are approved, they get into a cycle to come back. And I guess I'd start with the conditional approval. You said all new programs have a conditional approval and have to be revisited within a year. That doesn't even seem logical either, in that you might have an excellent program that's been operating for a while. You've gone in, you've done all this scrubbing, maybe they're top notch. You know, it doesn't seem like it should be an automatic revisit in a year, and it can free your time to go deal with those places that have greater issues. What's your view on
that? That's the approved process and procedure that's been approved over the years by the State Board of Education, and it's actually not, it's not titled a conditional approval for those new programs. It is just the way new programs are approved.
Right. No, I don't care what you call it. It just seems odd that you automatically have to go back a year later and do this whole process again, given that you may have just done presumably a thorough scrubbing to give them approval in the first place. Mm-hmm. And you know, if they're top notch and everything's flying along, it wouldn't seem like that should be an automatic thing that you have to do.
It shouldn't. It would seem that way, but I think because there are so many requirements behind the approval of a private special education program, what I find is that we would probably be giving the same amount of consultation, either throughout the year or at the end of the first year, to those programs, because it's the first time they've operated under the guidelines of the approved private special education program. So it's not unusual to go back in, and really it's an opportunity for the school to get some consultation. I think personally, when we go in to do these approvals, it really isn't with the focus on kind of I got you, and we're trying to pick apart the program. We're really in there for program improvement purposes. And so we try to make it a process where there's open communication between us at the State Department and the approved private schools, so that when issues come up, we have pretty good open communication. And it's a supportive kind of role for the department to these programs, too. And I think, you know, I can't speak for newly approved programs, but I think they would recognize and appreciate the fact that we do come back in to kind of assist them in ensuring that they're on target.
Okay.
And they're maintaining their approval.
Okay. Probably the thing that surprised me the most was when you talked about approval and then the up to 5 years, and where you said it's 3 to 5, and that may depend in large part on the types of deficiencies that are identified. And what strikes me as odd is that these schools have to cure their deficiencies in order to get the approval in the first place. Now you're coming back to a school that's been approved, and you're finding deficiencies, and yet you're granting approval for multiple years, and I don't quite understand that.
Well, I think when you look at some of the standards, and again, it's a fine line between what's the responsibility of the approved private school and what's the responsibility of the sending district, of the LEA. When we go back in, most of the time our deficiencies that we find are in the appropriate completion of the IEP. And the responsibility of that actually falls with the LEA. But on the flip side, it's also a responsibility of the approved private special education program to go back to the LEA to say, we can't possibly, one of the standards is that they have to implement a program in full. If that IEP is not completed either accurately or completely by the school district, the approved private school has to go back to the district and say, we need you to complete the IEP, we need you to clarify things in the IEP. So that in itself, if I go in and find missing pieces of the IEP or inconsistencies in that IEP, that in itself would be considered a standard deficiency. But here's
what I'm struggling with, right? Are you saying would that be the type of standard deficiency that would have to be corrected by a school seeking approval before they could get it in the first place?
No, because they won't have IEPs. I'm talking about the reapproval of schools in this setting. You asked about...
Well, so what happens with the 10 students that a school that needs to seek approval in the first place has? They don't have IEPs from their LEA?
Many of them do. Many of them do have IEPs from LEAs that have been developed through either mediated agreements or settlement agreements,
okay,
which are conducted between, say, a parent and a school district outside of the PPT. But the school district maintains an IEP and the responsibility for that IEP because they are maintaining some fiscal responsibility in that agreement for sending that student there.
Right. So so there is an IEP for some or all of the students that are in a non-approved school, perhaps. Let's say there is, and let's say that's one of the standards that's not being met. They'd have to cure that before they could get approval from the State Department or not?
No, they would not be cited that during that first approval period.
So they could be approved without meeting those standards, but subsequently get a lesser...
Right, so a year later we go back and then we make sure that they now have a valid IEP.
Okay. Okay, I guess I remain confused, but we do have other speakers, so I don't want to dominate the time here, and I guess we'll have some follow-up questions that we can do offline. Others on the
Howard,
committee?
We're going to move with Howard first, and then we're going to work down the line from Patrice and then all the way down. Howard, go right ahead.
Yes, thank you, and I will apologize to the committee and to the rest of the speakers. I do have to leave in a few minutes. The state has a new policy called facilitation, and I've got to facilitate a meeting downstate. I have a question as far as the cost to local school districts. You know, I have found over the years that, you know, cutting through everything, cost is a very serious factor in these placements. And, you know, Connecticut certainly has done a rigorous and a job in approving the private schools. And, you know, we have a good group that offers a lot of variety for districts and parents. But what do you have an idea, maybe you're the wrong person, of the percentage of cost local districts get when they make these placements? I mean, these placements, we're not talking about a small amount of money.
No, I couldn't tell you, Howard.
All right, just in one last question. Is there a difference in reimbursing a school district when the placement is in a non-approved special ed school, but they've qualified and they meet the standards to apply for reimbursement? Is there a difference in percentage?
I can't answer that question either. I think these are questions that would probably be better suited for Kevin Chambers, because really the purpose of the role of the consultant in the Bureau of Special Ed is really around the programmatic issues and meeting the needs of identified special education students. You know, we don't even collect information on tuition of our approved private special education programs, so it's
okay. Thank you
between
very
much. The districts and the towns.
Thank you, Howard. Thank you for that answer. Patrice, then we'll go Deborah, and then we'll go down that line, and then Bob, you will go after that last person on that end of the line.
Thank you very much. The presentation has been very helpful, and it's obvious that the approval process is very rigorous, which makes me even more curious about those programs where Connecticut children are educated which are not approved. Do you know how many Connecticut students are educated in non-approved programs?
I do not have that number.
Okay. If at some future time the chairs could facilitate us getting that information.
Again, there's probably a variety of... I don't know that we could ever capture that number because some of our special education students are not placed by districts. they're placed by their parents in these approved other approved private programs?
Well, my greatest interest would be in the ones
LEAs.
That are the responsibility of an LEA. And also, I would like in the future, if we can follow up on the issue Howard raised in terms of the reimbursement and what programs, under what circumstances LEAs are able to receive reimbursement when students end up in non-approved programs. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrice. You raised great questions, and I know we're taking notes and we're compiling a list, and then we'll explain after we're done what our next direction is.
Thank you. Does the Bureau have any influence or any recourse over non-approved programs that market themselves as special education facilities? And I have some exhibits of a specific program that happens to be in the town where I work, where they clearly market themselves as a special education facility. So is there any recourse whatsoever at the Bureau?
You know, I guess it comes down to the language used in some of their literature that other schools provide. But, you know, basically, my hope is that although they are advertising themselves as a special education facility in the state of Connecticut, they're not advertising themselves as a facility, a special education facility that has been approved as an approved private special education program. I think they are probably a program that is on that approved non-public school list.
Yes, I believe they are. But they definitely are not approved by the Bureau.
And they service special education students within that program. So, again, I think, you know, my hope would be that at some point there's more clarity between, you know, the non-approved public school list and the approved private special education program list. But
so
they are a private facility. They're just not approved by us.
So there's that gray area where they can. Okay. And just to follow up, I just would like to call the committee's attention to what clearly is a through line that runs across this and several other topics that we've already addressed. We have a non-approved program here, as I said, that markets itself as a special ed facility. This, I can attest to the fact that this places pressure on local school districts to support students who have been unilaterally placed there by their parents. And that ties directly to, again, those questions of due process and burden of proof. And I just don't want the committee to lose sight of that through line that ties all of these topics together. You really can't parse them out when you get to the nitty-gritty. Thank you.
I could not agree with you more. And the first name on my tip of my tongue was the same school that you just held up. So thank you for that. And Mike, you are next.
A couple of questions I know you might not have the answers for, but I'm going to throw them out to see if we can get the answers. Do the approved programs have nonprofit status?
Some programs have nonprofit status, and some are identified as for-profit programs. So both are acceptable in the application.
And is there a list of which ones are for-profit and which ones are not for-profit?
No. That information would be available through each of the program's application, but we've not parsed out those schools as profit or nonprofit, listing them.
Is it possible to get that information?
Yeah. Okay. You could request it on the individual schools. That would be the easiest way to do it.
And what's the level of required transparency in terms of their financial status?
Again, they have to provide us with the most recent annual audit as part of the application. I will tell you now, I'm not an auditor. I'm not a financial person. I review those annual audits that are part of their application, basically to ensure that there is a level of fiscal, they have the fiscal ability to operate the program. And beyond that, we don't look any further into the annual, so we don't really get into the financial piece of the program. I don't, through the approval process of their tuition costs. And, you know, I look for, are they able to run a program? And that's part of the reason why they have to be in operation for, you know, if there's a fiscal issue and they haven't been able to maintain the program fiscally over the course of a year, that tells us something. But the annual audit is available, and they have to, again, through the annual attestation, attest to the fact that there is an audit done that's available to the LEA and to the parent upon request and to the state upon request. But we don't request them every year.
So it's not something that's readily available to someone. They actually have to reach out and make that request.
Right.
Okay, because that would tie into if they're receiving funds from the LEA,
mm-hmm.
Local funds or whichever way, and they have to comply with all state and federal mandates, it would just seem sensible to have full transparency of how those monies are actually, where they're going.
Mm-hmm. And as part of the standards, those kinds of documents, they're required to provide them upon request.
Right. Okay. And finally, is there a similar to districts, school districts, is there a report card for each of the programs? One of the goals of these programs should be or is to return kids back to district.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any level of report card that gets published yearly on the success rate of each program?
No, and I think part of the reason there is not. And I think the other consideration that has to be given is that it's almost impossible to compare private school programs to private school programs. In many cases, we have programs that have over, 200 students enrolled. We may have a program that has 14 students enrolled. The disabilities categories and the needs that are addressed through various programs, the range is, students who are in hospital beds and need medical attention during their day to, again, those students that may have a significant learning disability and have them placed because the district feels they can't address those needs, and everything in between. So, the outcomes for the individual programs, certainly that's information that a district or a parent can ask of an approved private program. And some of our programs are suited for students who may have some more long-term needs, while other programs, we have some programs who operate within the public school setting. So from day one, I think in most cases, these programs are working on plans to reintegrate the students back into the public schools. So again, there's such a variety of the programs.
Thank you. I know your wheels are spinning just like mine are, and I keep jotting notes down. Deborah, go ahead.
Colleen, thanks for your presentation. I just want to provide a clarification because I've heard this stated a couple times by members of the committees that the department doesn't actually set rates nor control rates or tuition nor approve tuition. Unlike some other state agencies that have very fixed rates, that's not the case with private special ed.
That's correct, with the exception of 11 programs that are considered residential treatment programs that have been established for the purposes of other agencies placing them in those programs, such as DCF, and the students are placed more for non-educational reasons than educational reasons. There is a rate-setting process that DCF holds for the residential component, and then that information gets passed on to our fiscal office, and there is a process for setting the educational rates for their programs. And a school could not, an LEA could not, they can only receive up to that tuition cost, use that tuition cost to request their excess cost grant. And that's primarily because when another state agency places a student in a residential treatment program like that, the LEA or the local education, the district has no control over that placement. They basically have no say in whether or not they would choose to place that student there, or maybe they could educate them in their home school district, but because of the need for the residential component, they're not able to do that. So there are right now, I believe, 11 programs for whom an educational rate is set by the State Department of Ed.
So the other rates that are set are just set by the programs themselves?
Correct. The
ones that are
published. Programs themselves establish their rates. Yeah. They establish a contract. You know, it's basically the private school contracting, the LEA contracting with the private school, and they set their rates. We don't have anything to do with tuition rates.
Okay. I know that we have just two more questions, and here's my concern. We do have another presenter that is sitting here, and we do not want to push their day off for the rest of the afternoon. So I know that Shelley, you had a question. I know that Bob, you had a question. Kimberly, you have a question. This is what I'm going to ask of you all. I'm going to do this with my questions as well. If it's something that we can hold on, and I'm not saying not. If it's something that would help tie up something, then we will ask it. If it's something that we're going to seriously need some more information about, my request is, as I'm going to do with mine, to give us those questions. Because we're going to ask them to come back to present on the questions that we do have concerns of with documents and with the people that could possibly answer the questions if, in fact, the person that's, you know, that our presenter cannot answer. If that's fair for you all, does anybody have a question that is pressing or that would follow up on something? Okay, Bob, and then you will be our last person, and then we will collect questions accordingly. Thank you.
You'll be happy to know this is not finances.
Thank you.
In the approval process, you talk about the when the team comes to review the applicant, you talk about them reviewing each IEP for the students there.
I apologize if that's the way it was stated. Basically, what we do is we do a sample of, I go in on day one, or consultant will go in on day one. We look at anywhere from 5 to 10 files.
Like you would on an audit?
Depending on the size of the program. And then the team follows up the second day. What we do is we go in, the team members will go into a classroom with a student's IEP, one student within that classroom.
Okay.
And use that as a guide.
Sure.
To determine and verify that an IEP is being implemented in that setting.
So, but then there's a five-year window where you don't review those.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in your conversation there, you talk, you discuss.
Could be 3-4.
You discuss the role of the LEA in regards to the IEP.
Mm-hmm.
And so refresh my memory. Who's really in charge of that IEP? Because if it's
the LEA is in charge of that IEP. That is their responsibility. The approved private special education programs cannot make any changes or deviate from that program plan without contacting the LEA, going back to PPT, and that IEP is developed by the district's planning and placement team.
Okay, so if the LEA believes that the IEP is not being followed,
mm-hmm.
what's that there? How do they respond to that, or what control can they have over that?
Well, they have total control over that because it's really their contract with that private facility, and if that private facility is not meeting the terms of that contract or meeting the requirements of that IEP, that's up to the district. I mean, the district can say, you know, unless you do this, we're no longer going to support this placement and go back and seek, you know, a different placement for the student if they don't feel that this program is, in fact, meeting the needs of their student.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for your information. And as stated, we will reach back out to you for another date to follow up to go through with some more questions and move along from there. And thank you all, the committee, for your attention and questions and understanding that we need to be respectful of our following presenter. So at this time, we would like to ask forward private special education program outside of Connecticut, which would be the Windward School from New York, Dr. John J. Russell, the head of the school. Dr. Russell, are you bringing anybody else with you to the table, or is it just going to be you and your great little laptop?
It's going to be me and my laptop.
Excellent. Thank you very much, and that, you may start whenever you are ready.
While we're waiting for the technology to boot up, just in way of introduction, my three children went through and graduated from the Newtown Public Schools. I taught in Darien and in Greenwich, and as part of my healthy living plan, I have to tell you that I'm a recovering public school superintendent. Those who are superintendents know that that process can be a long one. Okay, so you can see already that technology is not my long suit, but I think this thing will be behaving. So first, let me thank you for inviting me here today. I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to present you with an overview of the Windward School, and needless to say, I'm happy to entertain any questions at any time. And if what I say isn't clear, please just stop me. I came to Windward 8 years ago and left the superintendency to do that. And it has been the most rewarding 8 years of my life. And so what I speak to you as if I were a reformed smoker, and hope you'll take that into consideration as I walk you through this presentation about the Windward School. So first, I thought it appropriate to begin with the mission of the school. And Windward's an independent school. It's co-educational. We have what we think is a proven instructional program. And we provide instruction for children who have language-based learning disabilities, the most prevalent one being dyslexia. We are very steeped in research. In fact, we subscribe to the philosophy that anything we do in our school should have a basis in the research. And I don't mean qualitative anecdotal research. I mean really empirical research that has a control group and proven results. We believe in direct instruction in small class settings. We do not ascribe to a tutorial model or a one-on-one because our job is to return students to the mainstream. On average, a student stay at Windward for 4 years. 50% of our students come from public schools, 50% come from independent schools. 99% of our students, when they leave, return to mainstream schools. One of the key other components of the school is its commitment to ongoing professional development about the most current research. So I'm going to take you through each component in this mission statement and try and demonstrate to you how we actually live this mission statement. I've been involved in a lot of interesting and good organizations, all of which had mission statements, none of which anybody really knew about except for the once or twice a year that they dragged them out and reviewed them. That's not the case at Windward. So first, in terms of background, I think you'll find this interesting. At least I've skipped the slide. About who we take. We are very, very focused on our admissions criteria. In order to be at Windward, you have to have an average to above average intelligence, and you have to have a diagnosed language-based learning disability. And the important piece about this is we do not do the diagnoses. A long time ago, the school made, a very wise decision, recognizing the potential conflict of interest in being the person who's doing the diagnosis and providing the service. So we insist that a full neuropsych evaluation be done, and the only children who get into Windward are children who have a diagnosed language-based learning disability. I would also point out that we triage, and we will take the students who need the most, who need remediation the most. So another way of saying it, we're the reverse of most independent schools. In order to get into Windward, you have to fail the entrance exam, and then when you start doing really well, we ask you to leave. And that's how the school operates. We also have a requirement that there be no other primary learning or behavioral issues. I don't know about you, but I will confess to you that I have behavioral issues. My wife could catalog them for you at great length. So when I say no primary learning and behavioral issues, the emphasis is on primary. So we know there's a comorbidity of dyslexia and language-based learning disabilities with attention deficit issues, and about 40% of our students have attentional issues, and it's possibly more. And then finally, even if you meet those three criteria, we have to have a group for you. You'll see one of the things that we do that is not politically correct but instructionally sound is we group homogeneously for all skills-based instruction. So if we're grouping homogeneously for reading and for math, we have to have a group that you fit into before we'll accept you. So any questions on the admissions criteria? So it's a real select group. Where do these children come from? We're also a very data-driven school, and I could have break this down in a lot of other ways, but I thought this was probably the best way to give you an overview of where our students come from. Connecticut typically gives us about 20% of our students. Most of our students come from the southern tier of Fairfield County, from Greenwich, Darien, Wilton, Westport, and you can see those percentages haven't varied much over the course of those 5 years that are 6 years that are up there. About 20% of our students come from Manhattan, and that's also been slightly increasing over the years. We have children from Brooklyn and Queens. We have the bulk of our students are from Westchester and Putnam counties, and a few from Rockland. And amazingly, we have children who travel to us from Long Island. We have a first grader this year who gets on a bus and travels from Oyster Bay, violating one of my erroneous rules of commuting, and that is never cross a bridge in a commute. This poor child has to commute about an hour and a half each way to get to the school. So that's where our students come from, and again, it's been consistent. I'll come back to enrollment a little bit later on and explain to you a little bit about the depth of a challenge that we face at the school. So first, let's look at the curriculum. We ascribe to some really important underpinnings about the curriculum, and this is a quote from Louisa Motes, who will is on the IDA board. And unlike what I once believed, which was based in whole language, I've come to the very clear realization that reading is not natural. Speaking is. Reading is a man-made convention. It started about 5,000 years ago. Our brains were not hardwired for reading. They are hardwired for speech. And most children need to be taught through a structured and protracted process that makes them aware of the correlation between sounds and symbols. Another way of saying it, in my experience, and I've been doing this for 43 years, about 60% of children you can put in front of a classroom and they'll learn to read almost on their own. But if you look at the NAEP data, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, over the course of the entire history of NAEP, what you'll find is about 40% of our students nationwide, these are not special ed students, these are everybody, don't learn to read proficiently the way we're teaching them currently. Despite that abysmal record.
Sorry, what was that statistic?
The National Assessment of Educational Progress, year after year after year, approximately 40% of all students read below the proficient level on that test. And for students with disabilities, I think the last number was 67% of students with disability read below that level. And I think part of that issue, at least the school does, is that these students aren't receiving the instruction that they need to become proficient readers. And it's based on our belief that that reading is not a natural process and they have to be taught directly. So what do we use to teach our children? Well, we're a multi-sensory curriculum program, and we use the work that was originally based on Samuel Orton and Anna Gillingham work from 1925, but we've also updated that research. But it's amazing to me how well that research has served the test of time and is still very relevant. The other researchers, and these are just some of the documents that we use, and I'm sure you're all familiar with the National Reading Panel in 2000, Reading Next, Writing to Read, and Teaching Elementary Schools and Students to be Effective Writers. These documents and others form the research basis for our curriculum. And our curriculum is a research-based program that has several components. First is phonemic awareness. We actually teach phonemic awareness to the younger students and all the students who need it. Second, a systematic phonetic instruction. Now, I have to tell you, as part of my recovery process, I was a superintendent, and I would have told parents, oh, yes, we teach phonics. And we did. And we did it earnestly, and we did it sincerely, like I believe every teacher tries to do the best they can. But what we didn't do is we didn't do it systematically, and that is absolutely the key, and we do it here. We also teach children fluency. It's interesting. One of the schools that we receive children from, who, for the purpose of this meeting, will remain nameless, they don't let their students read aloud, which to me is akin to teaching a child to play the piano, but saying, don't actually play, I'll just go through the motions. So we actually have the children read aloud, and that's how we check for fluency and instruct in fluency. We have direct instruction in vocabulary. We use the work of Isabel Beck to guide us. We find it very informative and very powerful. We also directly teach strategies for comprehension. And for us, a key component of our reading program is our writing program. Some of you may be aware of an article that appeared in Atlantic Magazine a few months ago, written by Peg Tyre. It documents the story, the transition, the amazing metamorphosis of a school in Staten Island that was on the chancellor's hit list to be closed because the students were performing so poorly. 4 years ago, the staff from Newdorp came up to Windward and started to learn about our writing program. They implemented the writing program, and they have turned the school around. So if you're interested in a real article about a real public school in a very tough socioeconomic position that turned it around with one incremental step, I would recommend that article to you.
What was the name of the school again? Because we can
New
all
Dorp
Google
High School.
New Dark?
New Dorp. D-O,
thank you.
When you type it in, it'll say it's incorrect. It's D-R-O-P-H.
Oh.
New D-O-R-P-H. Yeah, New
Great.
Dorp High
thank
School.
You.
So, having a research-based curriculum is a start, but obviously necessary but not sufficient, because that curriculum has to be delivered. And the National Reading Panel had one of those aha moments that when I say it, it seems so obvious. Teachers' knowledge of language is critical for reading and academic success. Again, another underpinning, overarching belief that we have is that you learn to read and then you read to learn. And if you don't learn to read, your academic success is almost destined to a failure. You won't be successful. So that came out of the National Reading Panel. So what does our research-based instruction look like? One of the great studies ever done for educational research and which has been ignored also at a colossal schedule is a program called Project Follow Through, where they looked at literally thousands and 180, I think it was, different school districts. And they tracked it over, I think it was 10 years. And what they did was they looked at 11 different instructional methodologies. And this was really excellent research. And what they discovered is that direct instruction is the most efficacious way of delivering instruction. This was geared particularly for kids of low socioeconomic status. And it was the most efficacious. And we have seen other research to support this over the years, and so we use direct instruction. So at Wynwood, you will not see children sitting in a circle looking at each other. You will see them sitting in rows looking at the teacher. We have this kind of antiquated notion that teachers actually have something to deliver to the students, and the teachers are required to do lesson plans. Every lesson plan has to have an aim, and there are seven components of direct instruction that we require in every lesson. Another piece that makes our instructional program somewhat different from some places, children are grouped homogeneously for skills-based classes. That means reading and math. And they're grouped heterogeneously for social studies, science, art, physical education, and all of the other subjects. The common sense piece about homogeneous instruction to me is I thought about going into the emergency room of a hospital and sitting in the emergency room and everybody with a different ailment and the doctor having to treat all of us basically the same because they're stretched for time. We asked teachers to do, almost the impossible when we put so many different levels of instruction that are needed in a classroom. So we're fortunate. We group homogeneously. Those are fluid groups. I went to elementary school about 150 years ago, and it was so long ago, we were also grouped homogeneously. But if you were a buzzard or an eagle, you were a buzzard. It was a life sentence. You never became an eagle. That's not what this grouping is. The teachers are able to move students from group to group because we monitor progress continuously during the instruction. The students get three periods of language arts a day. This is another part of my recovery. When I was superintendent, I actually would straight face tell parents, you know, your little Jimmy can't keep up with his class. But don't worry, we're going to give him extra help called remedial reading. And then you would ask me, well, what does that mean? And I'd say, it means we're going to teach the same material, but we're going to do it more slowly. This is the only race where by going slower, you can catch up. You can't catch up by going slower, but you can catch up by going slower and increasing the dosage. So we increased the dosage, and that three periods of language arts is truly an incredibly effective strategy, and you'll see that later. So we also insist that all of our teachers be language arts teachers so that our physical education teachers, our art teachers, our science teachers, our math teachers are all taught about language so that they can instruct the children with direct, explicit, and structured, sequential, and systematic multisensory instruction. Our instruction is diagnostic and prescriptive. We continually monitor our children's progress, and we adjust the instruction accordingly. So, we've got a research-based program. We're paying close attention to instruction in terms of what we expect. Then we monitor that instruction. So we have an evaluation system that is based on the work of Charlotte Danielson, and we think it's a very good evaluation system in terms of the research that Charlotte has done. We use multiple observers in order to increase the reliability and validity of our observations. New teachers are formally observed three times a year, informally almost on a weekly basis. Observation is part of what we do, and feedback is also. Probationary teachers are twice a year, and non-probationary teachers. We do not provide our teachers with tenure. We use a term called non-probationary status, recognizing the fact that they've been there 5 years or more, but their contracts are yearly renewable. The evaluation system provides them, the teachers, with valuable information about their performance. We emphasize the positive aspects of lessons and validate the good work that our teachers are doing. And we also talk about the things that where there is room for improvement. We ascribe to the philosophy of continuous improvement. So, one of the problems the school faces is hiring teachers, and I'm going to be a little bit critical of my friends at the college and university levels who do teacher preparation. Well, actually, I'm going to be very critical, but I hope not harsh. The simple truth is that we have found that teacher preparation programs simply do not sufficiently prepare new teachers for the classroom, and there is research to support this. This is Walsh et al., and the quote is, courses provided in teacher licensing program are often insufficient in content and design to enable the students, those are the teachers, to learn the subject matter and apply it to teaching of reading. So my crystallizing moment with this was we had a teacher apply to us who had just received a degree in social studies and wanted to be a social studies teacher. And I asked to see her transcript, and I saw that as one of the requirements to fulfill her major, a requirement to fulfill her major was the history of baseball. That speaks for itself. Louisa Motes again, and Reed Lyon, who are also very much associated with the International Dyslexic Association, focus their attention more specifically on teaching children language and insufficiently developed concepts about language, and their words, a pervasive conceptual weakness in the very skills that are needed for direct, systematic, language-focused reading instruction. So, I think this is the most telling quote I can possibly give you. The president of Teachers College, teacher preparation programs range from inadequate to appalling. So what do we do about that? We provide a lot of professional development. So again, there's this commitment, if you work at Windward, that you're, and this goes for everybody, including me, your professional development is never done. There's always something to learn. There's research that's informing practice, and we expect that you're going to be current on that, and we're going to help you be current on that. The research we have and that we promulgate is research-based practices. Again, when I was superintendent, I had programs for the teachers that were as far from research-based as they could be. They were entertaining. They were relaxing. They were good for the teachers in the sense that they built camaraderie, but they weren't research-based. We're on the opposite end of that spectrum now. In fact, in order to do this, we have established a teacher training institute at Windward. That teacher training institute presents courses for the general public, for the education community at large. Every year for the past 8 years, we've had at least 1,500 teachers from the New York metropolitan area and as far away as New Zealand come to the Teacher Training Institute to take courses in our core reading and writing programs and our language programs. They're not limited to those, but I know that you don't want me to drone on, so I'm editing that. The other key piece, if you did get a master's degree from, I'll use Columbia, since the president criticized it himself, if you came to us with a master's degree from Columbia and you were taught 10 years in a very fine independent school or a very fine public school, we would not let you teach your first year and probably your second year. You would work in a classroom with one of our master teachers so that when you went and took the professional development courses that we offer, and we do that, by the way, we dismiss children every Friday at 1:30. And every Friday from 1:30 to 3:30 is professional development. And we're fanatical about that and keeping to it. So you participate in professional development, and then you actually get to see it in situ as a master teacher delivers that lesson the way it's supposed to be done. You get feedback from your master teacher, and you go through a 1 to 3 year process. If you don't make it by 3 years, we don't keep you. We ask you to leave. So our assistant teachers frequently are certified teachers, master's degree level, who move through this program. Because what we found is that research-based programs don't deliver the results unless you deliver the program as prescribed. The phrase we use to capture that thought is we try to adopt, not adapt, research-based programs. And we feel that that's the right way to go. So, just kind of summarize this. Workshops, courses, and lectures provided at the TTI. Faculty meetings, professional development, 2 to 4 hours every week for professional development. We have support from curriculum coordinators in each curriculum area that help new teachers master the curriculum and the instruction. We have speech. We're a school for kids with language-based learning disabilities. It's not surprising we have speech and language pathologists. But what is surprising is the speech and language pathologists do not work with the children. They work with the classroom teachers because the classroom teachers need the language skills to be able to communicate effectively with the children. So one area that we really focus on a great deal is on questioning techniques and how to scaffold questions to make them accessible to the students. We are certified. We have an absolute charter from the state of New York. We are a member of the New York State Association of Independent Schools, and we are also IMSLIC certified. Most of you probably have never heard of IMSLIC. It stands for, let me see if I can get this acronym right, the International Multisensory Language Education Consortium, which is an EUA. Anybody know what an EUA is? Easily understood acronym. Come on. So let me just tell you one of the things we worry about. And you've actually spoken about it a little bit today with the previous presenter. I have great concerns, and the school has great concerns about initiatives, as much as they are well-intended, such as RTI, response to intervention. When we get children who are in first and second grade, have been identified by a psychologist as having a language-based learning disability, we can remediate them without too much difficulty. However, a lot of well-intentioned people, by the way, I left out an important factor I should have told you. My daughter has a language-based learning disability. She's now 30 years old and completely, well, she's completely remediated, just completed a master's degree at NYU. She's doing fine. I didn't know this when she could have used me, unfortunately. So what happens if a child is not remediated with just identification? Well, there's a wait-to-fail attitude that is all too prevalent in across the country. Not in every classroom, not in every school, but I would submit too prevalent. I get these kids, so I know it's true. Then it's exponentially more difficult because now this child has experienced failure, and we basically have to convince them that they are bright, intelligent kids and capable of success. Sometimes that isn't enough, and the child still goes unremediated. And now, if you're a bright student and you're meeting with failure, and you happen to be 12 or 13, for some of our students, it's far better to be viewed as not caring, unmotivated, and the class clown, the wise guy, and you get to start, you start to see emotional and motivational issues that begin to become prevalent. If you still don't remediate, now you get anxiety and depression. Those of you who are educators in the group, I don't know if you've seen what I've seen, but I am astounded in my 42 years at the incredible number of children now who come to us with real significant anxiety problems. That's what happens if we wait too long to remediate students. So, this is the work of Emerson Dickman. Mr. Dickman was on the IDA board. He's an attorney in New Jersey who represents learning disabled students and disabled students in New Jersey. So, what do you get if you take a research-based program, direct instruction, supervised and supported faculty, and a constant professional development? You get positive results. I'm going to walk you through this quickly. I track every student who's been in the school since I've been there. And 1,049 students have left the school during the course of those years. When they came here, this is what their scores on the Stanford Reading Test. We administer this to students when they arrive at the school. So this is before any intervention. Now, I'd like you to keep in mind that our students are of average to above average intelligence. This graph does not represent average to above average intelligence. This represents, at best, a normal curve, but it's a normal curve that's skewed, and it's skewed to the low end. So if anything, our kids should be all performing in the average to above average range, if that's their intelligence. More significantly, those of you who are familiar with the Dibbles research are aware that if you score below the 23rd percentile on a standardized reading measure in third grade, your chances of making literacy benchmarks in eighth grade are greatly diminished. If you don't make literacy benchmarks in eighth grade, your chances of graduating from high school are virtually nil. So, and by the way, the National Transition Committee has an interesting is the wrong word, a shocking statistic. 36% of all disabled students, now that's all disabled students, not just learning disabled, 36% of them do not graduate from high school. So a very telling statistic. So what happens when you do all the stuff? Well, we move that curve to the right where it should be. This is vocabulary. And you can see now another way of looking at this data. When they arrived, 34% of our students were below average, 58% average, and only 8% above average. When they left, we turned that curve upside down. 96% of our kids are in the average to above average range in vocabulary on this standardized measure. In reading comprehension, you can see this is even skewed more to the left, with below average students, and then way to the right when they leave. And again, I want to emphasize that the average student spends 4 years at Windward. So what does that look like in terms of percentages? 31% were below average when they arrived, and when they left, 98% of all those students since 2005 had reading comprehension scores in the average to above average range. I didn't want to bore you with undue amount of statistics, but I will give you the summary of it. We get the same results with math. And it's interesting, our school is known for reading and writing, listening and speaking, but we really do get the same results at math. And you can see that when they leave, 91% of our students are receiving above, are scoring in the average to above average range on the Stanford, and 97 in problem solving. So one of the things that I asked of ourselves, okay, so the immediate effect, the immediate result is good, but is it a persistent effect? Does it last? And how do our kids do when they go out to the mainstream? So we wait 2 years after a cohort leaves, and then we don't send these surveys to parents, although all of us could be completely objective with our own children. Some parents aren't quite as objective as we are. So we send it to administrators and guidance counselors at the schools where our children go. Again, 50% go to public schools, 50% go to independent schools. And here's what we found out 2 years after they left. In terms of academics, and if you add that up, roughly 98% of our kids are at or above their average grade level peer, no matter what school they go, 2 years out in terms of academics. With language-based learning disabilities, those of you who have experience with this know that frequently there are social issues. Makes sense. If I have trouble with expressive and receptive language, I'm liable to misunderstand the cues you're making. So we pay attention to that. We actually teach social skills integrated throughout the classroom. That's a separate course, but it's part of what we do. And so we're interested how our kids appear to others when they go back to the mainstream. We get similar results. About 95% of our kids have average to excellent social skills when they leave, as judged by the schools that they attend. By the way, this is survey research, and I will tell you that it's about a 30% return rate on that survey. So that's pretty good in terms of survey research. It's not great, but I think it gives us some reliability. So that's it. I'm happy to answer questions.
I don't have any questions, but I just want to say this is what a presentation should be. It's awesome.
Oh,
it's been
you.
Specific. It's been clear. I know Windward. It's, as you and I spoke earlier, it's a number of students from the district I represent attend Windward for this reason. Just a note to David, I would love the future presentations to be like this, where we can put notes in the margins. It's very helpful. It's clear. It's specific. And you made a very, very clear point on and I've seen this, I don't think I'm exaggerating, by hundreds of times, where students are not identified with a learning disability. Oh, they're told in first or second grade, well, they're not really bright, they're a little slow, give them a little time. Fourth, fifth, sixth grade, it's determined they're dyslexic. Well, we're failing these kids. It is so wrong. So, and I've seen the bright kids, when they're not remediated, what happens? And it's one of the biggest failings in our state, in our society right now. It's across the nation,
yeah,
too.
My daughter, happily I was not at this PPT meeting, because I would not be sitting before you now. A psychologist, my daughter was in third grade. A psychologist leaned over to my wife and said, have you thought about beautician school for your daughter? Not that there's anything wrong with beautician school, but she's in third grade. So what are the expectations? So here's the problem we face. This September, we had an information session for prospective parents at the middle school, to your point. That's grades 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. In September, we had to tell the parents after the information session that we were already full for next year. We turned away this year, for next year, 90% of the qualified applicants, not 90% of the applicants, 90% of the qualified applicants. In sixth grade, we had six seats. We had 66 students apply for sixth grade. So much so, we're a not-for-profit. We could have been very happy sitting up in White Plains and just doing what we're doing. We actually felt, I think this is the right word, a moral obligation.
Totally.
And you know what? We're opening another school, another campus in Manhattan. And we picked Manhattan for a very important reason. We have parents who come up to us and say to me, you know, this is a miracle what happened to my child. And I said, no, that's the wrong way to categorize. I refuse to let you call it a miracle. She said, why? I said, if it was a miracle, we have some special power. We don't have a special power. We have some things that other people don't have, and we have some privileges. There's no doubt about that. But this is science. This is not a miracle. And I firmly believe, as a former superintendent, as a former teacher, that incrementally, every school could take pieces of this, and not WinWIS program, but just good research-based program, and our kids would be better off, and we wouldn't be losing kids, as you described, and as we all know. Unremediated dyslexics are going to get our attention one way or the other. Representative Wood and I were talking, you know, the National Committee on Learning Disabilities did a survey of prisons in New York State. And you're not going to be surprised by this. 80% of the prisoners had a diagnosed, when they did it, a diagnosed reading problem. Now, I'm not assuming causality there, but it is a striking correlation.
First meeting we had of this group, that was one of the things I'd mentioned. But I had referenced Bridgeport, that 50% of the boys who attend Bridgeport High School don't graduate. 60 to 70% of those boys have a diagnosed learning disability or a learning disability. It's wrong. It's so wrong. And this is something specific we need to be doing. We need to break out of the bureaucratic box we're delivering our education in. Sorry, I'm getting passionate about this. Anyway, statistic is accurate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any questions?
Given your experience in the public school system, do you think that this program or elements of this program could be replicated in a public school today, or do you think that there are too many restrictions or mandates that might prevent you from doing so?
Well, the answer to both questions is yes. There are too many mandates and restrictions. When my colleague was presenting what is required in Connecticut, I was saying, thank God I'm not a superintendent anymore. So there are things that get in the way of dedicated, hardworking teachers and administrators. So that's yes. But the answer to the first question is still yes. Absolutely, elements of what we do and can be replicated in public schools. New Dorp High School is a great example of that. I would say New Dorp is equivalent to Bridgeport High School in socioeconomic status and in terms of composition of student body. And they did it. They instituted the writing program, and they got tremendous change in results. So I hope I answered your question.
Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm just trying to relate this to our previous presentation so that we can figure out how to apply this information in the context of our private special ed schools in Connecticut. So does New York have a similar approval process in New York, and have you gone through that? And if so, was it helpful? If not, why not?
With all due respect. 30 years ago, WinWIS became laser focused on language-based learning disabilities. So we've been doing this for a long time. Prior to that, we had a wider net and took lots of different kids. But 30 years ago, my predecessors made a brilliant decision, and that is we chose not to be a state-approved school. And the reason we did it was, again, apologies, we didn't want to get caught up in the bureaucratic stuff that is necessary if it's a state-approved school. I mean, it's necessary. And we wanted to, you know, we have precious resources in terms of time and money. We wanted to put it in what I presented to you today, not in all the other stuff. We are state-approved from the perspective of we have an absolute charter from the state of New York. We go through an accreditation process through the National Association of Independent Schools. And as I mentioned to you, our teacher training program is accredited by the International Multisensory Language, whatever that thing is, consortium. So no, we're not state approved. Now, the good news is we don't get to do that. The bad news is CSEs and PPTs can't place kids directly in the school. It has to be a parentally placed child. Sure.
Thank you. That's Very interesting. I know. It is very good. Anybody else have questions? Go ahead, Terry.
What percentage of the students are reimbursed by their district for education at Windward?
It's another interesting quirk of the school. I don't know because I don't pay attention to that data. We, in the contract that the parents sign, we make it clear that we do not participate in reimbursement hearings. So we don't testify at them because we can't devote teacher time to it.
Thank you. Fair enough.
Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Okay, thank you.
This was extremely informative, and I don't... Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we're talking about a possible field trip.
Are you all welcome to visit? I'd love to have you.
Maybe we can figure out a good time for you all.
Those of you who are superintendents, we have an annual endowed lecture series that's coming up. I'd be happy to have you as my guest. We have a speaker, Dr. Gordon Sherman, who is a cognitive neuroscientist who became the head of a school for kids with language-based learning disabilities in New Jersey. He is our keynote speaker. Any of you who want to come, you're invited. And we have a little dinner beforehand that I'd be happy to host you at.
Do you have a date for that?
I do. It is April the 30th.
Oh. We end session May 7th, and I have a feeling we'll all be having dinner together up here. Yes.
Well, I'm sure it'll be just as much fun.
But thank you, and I think a very good point was made on importing, and part of the reason for a field trip is how can we import part of this into the public school systems here.
The last thing I'll add, and I guess I should have said this, it's interesting. My board of trustees are really very supportive. They're not current parents, which is interesting. Current parents, we do limit the number of current parents simply because some of them have agendae. The business model that we ascribe to is to put ourselves out of business. So we're very happy to help other people, other schools, take what we have and use it. We really would love not to exist. We realize that that's probably not going to happen. So, thanks, everybody.
We have one more question really quick, Bob.
Yeah, yes, about the tuition. And you were saying that the local, the LEAs are not paying it. So obviously it's the parents that are paying it?
Well, just let me reframe that a little bit. I'm sorry, I think I misled you then. In order to be reimbursed, the parents basically have to either sue or threaten to sue, and then they can be reimbursed by the local education association.
And what is the tuition annually?
$48,000.
Thank you.
Dr. Russell, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to come up here and share your information with us, and have safe travels back to New York.
Thank you. Goodbye. Good luck with your deliberations.
Thank you so very much. All right, our next presenter, and thank you all for being patient and attentive, Pat Garrity, President, CTA Association of Private Special Education Facilities. Come on down. And thank you for being patient and sticking it out with us. We understand that we're running a little bit behind, but I think that the information that we are receiving is extremely important and helpful.
Hi, everyone. So presenting today on kind of an overview of the private special state-approved. The state-approved Connecticut private special education facilities. And as already noted by Colleen, there are over 50 of them that are located throughout Connecticut. There are some that have more than one site. So I think it's like 49, but then there are three or four that have additional sites, which brings it up to the 58. All exceptionalities are addressed, and that by that I mean throughout the state, every exceptionality can be addressed in one or more of the facilities. However, some specialize, so there may be some that are specific to learning disabilities, deaf and hard of hearing, medically complex, but the majority really address those students who are referred with social, emotional, and behavioral disorders. Size and enrollment varies amongst all of the facilities, and size is in terms of the actual physical space as well as the number of students. And the number of students can vary from 10 to 210, again, depending upon the facility. Most referrals come from local education agencies, so the public schools send the referrals, but there are some of the privates that will take DCF referrals and or parent referrals. I'm also aware of one of the privates, and there may be more than one, Colleen might know, where they actually will take, they take students that are referred through the Court Support Services Division. And another point to note with, amongst all of us is that it's like rolling admissions in the sense that we take referrals on an ongoing basis throughout the entire 12 months of school, because most of us do have a some extended school year program. And the acceptance of those students would be dependent upon the presentation data that we have, the visit from the students, so that, you know, they have to, obviously, we have to have a spot that would be appropriate for that particular student. Amongst, I think, all of the privates, there is a high level of structure, routine, and predictability. The students tend to thrive on that, and small structured classroom setting is another characteristic. There are some that are also in community-based settings, however, a few that will have a portion of the day, and maybe as the student gets older, more of the day. Individual behavior plans that are consistently implemented, as well as the school-wide behavior support system. And I know that was discussed with Colleen as well, the individual behavior plans that are part of a student's IEP. And what's, I think, really important to note within the private schools is that everyone is aware of what those individual behavior plans are. So every staff member that's going to interact with that student knows that plan and is able to implement it and remain consistent for that child throughout the day, no matter which classroom they may be in or activity that they're encountering. And the school-wide behavior support system, same thing, where there's consistency for that child throughout the day, from month to month, and from year to year. Related services are provided as delineated in the IEP. So for those students that require speech and language intervention, occupational therapy, physical therapy, whatever it might be, there are many of the privates that actually have those staff write, you know, that are actually employees of the school, and they work there full-time, half-time, whatever it is. Others actually contract out for the services. And again, it's dependent upon the size of the school and the demand that, of the population that they serve. Diagnostic testing is provided as it's determined by the PPT. So if a student is, in need of a triennial evaluation or there's concerns that are discussed at a PPT that, you know, raise questions regarding the student's maybe gross motor skills, you might recommend a physical therapy evaluation. Those are conducted oftentimes within the school by school staff. However, there are some privates that would have where the actual public schools will send people in to do the testing, or again they may contract out. There are also some of the privates that will have diagnostic placements, so students not yet determined to be special education, but they will be referred to a private special ed facility for the purposes of diagnostic information in determining the student's profile and subsequent needs for programming. All of the privates, in accordance with the State Department of Ed regs, do administer CMTs, CAPT, and the Smarter Balanced, which Colleen had noted as well. And this year, some of us are doing both. The curriculum is aligned with the Common Core State Standards, and specialized instruction is designed per the individual student's IEP. So every individual, again, that works with the students within a private special ed facility will be aware of that student's IEP, will be aware of what the specialized instruction is, we'll make sure that it is consistent and carried out throughout the day. And there is data collection that occurs consistently across the programs, and that data collection is not just specific to maybe progress monitoring in terms of academic progress, but also in terms of the behavior, the specific concerns that the student may have been referred with that we are actually addressing. And data is collected, analyzed, and teams meet to determine what needs to be done, for greater improvement and progress. Another key note across the programs is a high staff-to-student ratio. There are some programs that have one-to-one, again, depending upon the population of kids and the size. Many of the programs have a one-to-4 or 1-to-5 ratio at the least. Again, students are given individualized attention, not only for instruction, but to guide them and direct them and give them consistent input with regard to the behaviors, or in the case of a student who's disruptive in a classroom, to be able to take them for a walk or to help get them back on track so that they can actually engage in the learning that's occurring. The staff within these schools are highly qualified and skilled and trained to work with this population. So as Colleen mentioned, the teachers are special education certified. Many of them are also elementary ed or content area certified. The assistant teachers that are in many of the schools will also be individuals who have a bachelor's degree and at least some coursework in education, if not certification. And there's intensive training that occurs with regard to behavior intervention strategies, and that is a real focus in many of the private special ed facilities, again, the ones that address those particular students. And it may be as much as up to 12 to 16 hours of training each year in addition to the original training that is presented. Many of the schools use a program called Therapeutic Crisis Intervention, although there are many different ones. That particular program requires initial training of 28 to 30 hours. And then subsequent to that, it's 12 to 16 hours each year for all staff that are intervening with students that have behavior concerns. Reading instruction is another area of focus for many of the schools, even when they're not specific, when it's not specific to just LD. But we find that a lot of the kids that have behavior issues are behind in their studies and in their core academic skill subjects, and a lot of that is because they were unavailable for learning prior to coming to us. The students are closely monitored, and they're prompted and encouraged throughout the day. And again, that can happen much more easily because of the staffing ratio that we have within the schools. So mentioning the fact that there are several, actually the majority of the private special ed facilities that do focus on the behavior, disordered kids, social, emotional, and behavior, those programs have a strong therapeutic component. So that is woven throughout the day. It is addressed through the therapists that are available. Clinical psychologists, clinical social workers are often right on staff. They work directly with the students. There's individual and group therapy that occurs throughout many, if not most, of the programs. There's work that's done with the families and coordination with outside agencies, with therapists and or with psychiatrists, so that there's a real a complete profile is addressed for this particular youngster, and all of the team players are kind of on board in terms of the program for the student. Certainly we find that when we have that component of cooperation with families, the student tends to progress at a faster rate. Again, with these students, emphasis is placed on emotional regulation for that individual student and safety. Many of the recommendations that came from the Task Force on Mental Health that was subsequent to Newtown are already incorporated into many of the private special ed facilities, inclusive of the staff training in mental health competencies, conducting risk assessments, expanding the presence of school nurses. Many of us have them on staff. They're there all the time or partial. And the ratio of psychologists and social workers to students, which in many of the facilities may be as low as 1 to 10. And then the whole component of transitioning, and I know that Mike Regan had brought this up as well, that, you know, the privates have a mission to work closely with the sending schools on behalf of each student to teach independence and self-monitoring skills and to provide them with coping strategies so that we can reintegrate them back to the public school and or into the community if the student is with us till the age of 21. In the event that we are transitioning a student back, we develop individual transition plans for successful reintegration and work very closely with the public schools in order to implement these. Across the board, they're individualized for that particular student, obviously with the intent of for the student to be successful in that return, and the pace can be at whatever rate the student can handle, but that's the goal and the mission for all of the privates. Questions?
Thank you. Members have questions? Kimberly?
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I actually had this question earlier for Colleen, but maybe you'd be the better person to answer it. Our finance department in our district has actually asked this question based on information that several of our administrators have heard. Is there a sense from your part that the private special ed schools are actually charging different districts different tuition rates?
Oh, I don't think, I'm not aware of that at all.
Okay, because I haven't been able to get any firm information on that practice.
Yeah.
And if that's even permissible, and it seems kind of odd to me, but more than one administrator has heard that when talking to their counterparts from other districts.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that. I can speak certainly for, you know, for our school and the schools that I'm aware of, and it's one fee for you know, it would be the same from district to district.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Good.
Do you, in the other schools, do you maintain the kind of data that we heard in the from the previous speaker, showing what the status of the student was on the front end and then when they're completed with the different schools? Do we have that?
I can't speak again on behalf of every school, but to say that many of them that I'm aware of, and inclusive of the school that I'm involved with, is that we do do progress monitoring, and that gets presented. So there's charting, there's graphing in terms of the progress that the student makes academically and behaviorally. That data is presented at PPTs. And then certainly when a student exits, we're looking at the progress that a student has made, you know, from the time of entry, for both the behavior component, if they were referred for those reasons, of course,
yeah,
as well as the academic growth.
And going back to Colleen, I guess, is that something you, I'm going to jump into her, but is that something the Department of Ed looks at when it's recertifying or one of these schools, their success or failure rate within on those on individuals?
And I think, you know,
so how do we judge whether a school is doing well or doing bad?
I think that each individual, you know, and it goes back to the fact that dependent upon the student, if you're dealing with a student who has average to above average intelligence, the expectation for the growth of that student is going to be different than it is in terms of a student who may have, you know, more deficient cognitive abilities. And we also are looking at different types of skills that we're assessing. So the student that has maybe significant cognitive deficits, we may be looking more at life skills and independent living and things like that, in addition to, you know, some very basic academics and social skills.
Others? Shelley?
Hi, thank you. My question is about the curriculum. You said it's aligned with the Common Core State Standards and
mm-hmm.
specialized instruction designed for the IEP.
Mm-hmm.
Who does the modification on that for the children?
All modifications and adaptations would be determined at the planning and placement team meeting in terms of what a particular student needs. That's part of the IEP.
Right. So their IEP does follow them to the private, because we had that conversation earlier and I wasn't too clear on that.
Yeah, so what happens is when a student is referred to a private special ed facility and they have an IEP, it comes to the school, there's a pre-placement PPT that must happen
mm-hmm.
before that student is actually placed, at which time the receiving school must review that IEP and determine whether or not they're able to implement every aspect. There may be a particular curriculum you know, that or curricula that they're recommending in the IEP that a kid may need, that we say, you know, we don't use, but we use this instead. And so that determination would need to be made before the student actually begins. But then we would follow through with that IEP and then make recommendations at every planning and placement team meeting for things that we think need to be changed.
Okay, so it might not be the Common Core that's put in place. Correct.
All of the goals and objectives that would be written for that IEP would be based on the Common Core.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Others? Representative Cook.
Thank you. On a line of what you just said about the goals and things that are based on the Common Core, obviously we have been having this massive conversation about the standards and whether they're age appropriate and the likes, and where they should start. So if you have a student that is not able to be is not adequately age appropriate for the standards of which are in place, what are the accommodations for a situation like that if we are required to stay with the standards, but yet we have students who have the need for modification, but yet you're saying that they have to stay in line with the standards? Can you explain where those discrepancies are? Because this, you know, in fact, deals with a good percentage of our population.
So are you referring then to students who are below grade level? And they is that what you're saying? You can still use, is that what you mean? I guess
I'm we'll start there, and then we might need to move forward from there. But we'll start with the ones that are below grade level.
Okay. So the actual goals and objectives, or the goals, would be based upon the state standards. And there are certainly, in Common Core, and there are certainly different ways of instructing students from particular objectives that are very basic to more complex. And that would be determined based on the student's ability level, and that is what would be identified within the IEP. Revisions to that would occur as the student masters those objectives.
You're rolling your eyes like I am too, and I'm trying to...
Go ahead.
I guess what my question boils down to, we're talking about children with special needs. We're talking about the special needs kids, and we've had this question on Common Core from the very beginning. Where do they fit in the structure of Common Core? And it really hasn't happened in a lot of settings, and so I wanted more specifics on that. How are we sure? How do you know that it's actually the Common Core, and if they are in line with it, based on the fact that some of them cannot do it? And so who's doing the modification of that?
The modifications, again, it would be, so you take a student from where they're at, looking at where they should be for that grade level in terms of what the standards are for that grade level, and then looking at what within that standard the student is going to be capable of doing at what level, the modifications would occur. At a PPT, those are discussed, and that is how the decision is made. You know, it's a joint decision made at a PPT.
But and I understand that, and we understand that, but at the same time, we're still struggling with the fact that if we have the level of standards that we're going to be required for the Common Core, and students are not going to be able to effectively reach those standards at the grade level they are supposed to be at, then where do we go for those students that cannot be performing at the grade level regardless of the standards and the modifications that might happen in the PPT?
So I guess if I look at a specific... I'm trying to think of an example that I can give you. So if we have a student and for that particular grade level, we're looking at maybe it's algebraic equations. And we have a student who is significantly below grade level in terms of mathematics. Then you can bring that particular objective down to the very basics of 2 plus, you know, question mark equals 4, and address it as basic as that in terms of algebraic equations. So I think it's the level at which you address it for that particular student based upon the standard.
I have an do you want to go? Because I have an example.
Let's take an example. So we have an autistic child that doesn't do math other than multiplication. Let's say we're on a sixth grade level and we're talking about very basics. We're talking about a child that's not very vocal or that you understand. How are we giving them Common Core and we're saying that it's in line? I mean, that's where I'm stuck at.
I think that it really is, it's going to vary dependent upon the child's ability, of course, but there are adaptations and modifications that can occur that can be more in tune with hands-on activities, understanding as it applies to daily living, vocational kinds of tasks and skills, those kinds of adaptations for that particular child. So it's not necessarily going to be exactly at grade level if the kid is not capable of doing eighth grade level and they have a cognitive ability that's in the intellectually deficient range.
But to follow up with that, if you have a student that is not there, then they are not adhering to the level of the standards of which we are putting forth.
For the child's grade placement.
Right. And so to make it a little bit more complex, although I think that that might be easier in one scenario, difficult in another, you take a student like my son who is in eighth grade, who's going to be going to high school next year, and would fall right into the school we were just at because he has dyslexia, although the district will not recognize it because they don't want to put a teacher there who is specialized in dyslexia. Mm-hmm. He can function very highly in a lot of areas that you do not have to use the phonetical part of the dyslexic component that he has. But at the same time, you put him into math now. He's a whiz at math. But you start integrating the word problems, he is no way going to hit the standard level.
Mm-hmm. If they're presented auditorily?
No. They don't present him any of that. And to the point now where, I mean, and this is a far greater conversation of which I'll deal with in the PPT next week, you know, that he was even removed from extra help on his testing last week without our knowledge. Mm-hmm. And, so the teacher sent him to three other teachers to get permission to have extra help, and then they told him no. That's another issue for me, not for here. Mm-hmm. But the issue I have is the fact that you have students that have such intricate individual needs and requirements. Mm-hmm. And if before the standards were put into place, we have issues, how are those issues going to be addressed moving forward with the standards put in place?
Mm-hmm. I think with that example, like if we have students, and again, I can't state that this is the way it is across all of the privates, but I do know that it's being done in several, if not, you know, many. In that particular situation, then a lot can be presented via with earphones, via computer, so that they hear it and they can hope, you know, have paper pencil to take notes if they want, but it even the word problems in math, either someone is reading it to them or they're able to hear it if they cannot read it themselves. So they're provided a reader or technology to help with that.
We were in education, we were given the information that headphones would be required or not required. I'm required?
For
SBAC, they're required.
Yes.
And the concern that was brought up about what about those students that could not because of audio situations in implants and ears and things like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Are those modifications are going to be allowed when we move forward in those situations?
I don't know the answer to that.
They will.
Yeah. It
they haven't been developed yet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, additionally, there are mechanisms.
I'm sorry.
Additionally, there are mechanisms in place through the planning and placement team process where the team can decide to request a special accommodation beyond what's available within the SBAC testing. And I'm losing the terminology used for that request, but I'll give you an example. And many of our deaf and hard of hearing students, there's built into the test, Smarter Balance test, is a sign language interpreter. For many of our deaf or hard of hearing students, that ASL, which is a different language, interpreter may not be appropriate. We have some students who need the reinforcement of signed English, say. In those cases, a special request can be made to the assessment office at the State Department of Ed for consideration of additional adaptations and modifications for that student, similar to the way we used to put in requests when we did CMT and CAP.
So with all of the concern and confusion and and all of that other uncertainty. Mm-hmm. When a parent goes forward now with the PPT and the changes that are being made, are they going to be educated as to the new options and abilities and adaptations that are going to be allowed? Because if they're not, I think that as a legislative body, we need to step in before it goes any further to make sure those are explained ahead of time, mm-hmm. to the point where 5 years ago we legislated that actually a district was allowed or needed to give a informal meeting before a formal PPT because parents were not understanding the process. It's too convoluted. It takes sometimes beyond a master's degree to understand just the paperwork, let alone the average person that doesn't have a specialty in special education.
Mm-hmm. Quite complex.
And it concerns me that we are putting families and students in uncharted territory, mm-hmm. without giving them any explanation and expecting them to adapt to it when the teachers alone are having issues adapting to it. And I think as we move forward, we as legislators have some significant work to do. If the state boards and the people that are putting this stuff in front of us don't have their checks and balances and T's crossed and I's dotted before we put people into those situations. And this can go on for days. So, did you have something else?
I was going to offer, certainly there's lots of controversy around Common Core and SBAC, so not going there. I think what you need to recognize is that whether it's Common Core or our previous standards, mm-hmm. there's always been a challenge for kids with the most significant disabilities of having a state standards and students with significant disabilities. And clearly, if you look at one of the programs that we run, which has probably the most challenged group of kids with autism in the state, although we do our best to align with whatever the standards are, whether it was Common Core or our previous grade level expectations, you will see it's a stretch. The IEP allows for specific individualized accommodations and modifications. So, for example, if we have an individual with autism who's nonverbal, who's a sophomore, let's say in high school, and let's say civics is supposed to be provided to sophomores in high school, and this person in one of the standards, because you have to realize the standards are pretty broad. It might be they understand governmental structure, you know, in the United States, in your state. So for an individual with autism, a really modified display of that might be showing that person two pictures and say, which one's the President of the United States? So that's a far cry from what we would expect an average sophomore in high school to be able to take on their test, but that's an allowable modification on an IEP if that's the level the person's at. And I think what you have to keep in mind, and I think there's confusion over, there are the standards and then there's the curriculum. So the curriculum is individualized district by district, and in some districts, modified curriculum for kids with disabilities. So you have to look at how those systems all work together. And again, I don't know that we want to get into the issue of Common Core versus not Common Core. It's modifications to whatever the state standards are, mm-hmm. that we're required to try to have that guide us. But it's a pretty, pretty broad guidance, if you will. It tells us it may be as much as what types of subjects the student should be exposed to that year. And then you go into where's this kid at and what makes sense. So.
And I understand that. I just think that when you're talking about populations of such a large umbrella, right. whether we are talking about the autistic community, the dyslexic right. community, the ELL, I mean, yes. whatever community we're talking about, the uncertainty is still so fearful.
Absolutely.
That we need to be very careful and cautious as we move forward to ensure that nobody gets hurt here. You know, that we're protecting our educators, we're protecting our students, our parents are being, they're being educated along with us through the process. And quite honestly, I think they are by far the most important component of this, or we're going to have problems, you know, far greater than what we realize. So, thank you.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. I just wanted to revisit an issue that we raised earlier, but we didn't have any financial experts from SDE here or anyone familiar with rate setting. Mm-hmm. Could you speak to that from your perspective and how the rates are set? And I think there were folks thinking that SDE actually had to approve all of those rates for each of the private institutions around the state before there'd be reimbursement?
No.
Could you just speak to the process, perhaps, and anything you may be able to share with us about rate setting?
To my knowledge, there is no rate setting. We do not share any of that information. We're not aware of what our colleagues or what the other private special ed facilities are charging. Each individual school has a rate structure that's been in place since the beginning of that particular school's inception. And determination is based as to whether or not those rates change dependent upon what the costs are for educating the students that we receive. So some years they may not change, and some years they may increase incrementally.
Thank you. Colleen, can I ask you another question, a follow-up on that then, which is as part of your approval process, and if you could step forward, as part of your approval process and the application process, do you take into account the rates that are given to you by these schools?
We don't ask for the rates, and we don't, therefore, take them into account. It's not part of the process.
Don't take rates into account as part of the process. Okay, great. Thank you. Anyone else have any questions? Representative Wood.
And I'm sorry to have missed the very beginning of your presentation, and perhaps you went through it then, but I'm on your website, and I'm just trying to figure out if you could say in one or two sentences what you do. What is it fair to say CAPSEF?
Yeah, CAPSEF is the Connecticut Association of Private Special Education Facilities, and all the private special ed facilities have the option of joining the organization. That's what you're asking is what the organization does, right? Yeah. And
Handout didn't say that. Doesn't go into what you all do.
Meaning the schools that participate in CAPSEF?
Well,
is that what you're asking?
Yes. Well, you went into what the schools do, but not what your organization does to support those efforts.
Right, and so it is a supportive organization in that, you know, we will discuss trends, we will discuss, you know, concerns, even some of the mandates that come out from the State Department of Education. We will provide training. We will ask speakers to come in. Deb actually came in and addressed the membership. We'll have Colleen come to certain meetings to talk about new initiatives at the state level and the implications for those within the private special ed facilities, some of the challenges that we may be up against and how to deal with that.
So it would be fair to say it's an umbrella organization for all these agencies,
mm-hmm.
for all these schools?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How many staff are at this Connecticut Association of CAPSEF? How many staff members are there at CAPSEF?
It's not really, yeah. I mean, CAPSEF is a supportive organization for the private special education facilities. So if you decide to join as a member of CAPSEF, there would be, usually it's the directors or the principals or whatever they're called, the 092 certified staff for the schools that will attend the CAPSEF-sponsored membership meetings, the trainings, the conference. We run an annual conference every year. This year it's on positive behavioral supports. We have speakers coming in and breakout sessions. We've done it on anti-bullying. You know, we have a different focus every year.
Okay.
But, yeah.
But you are paid.
No.
You're not paid.
No.
All right, I missed that then. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was trying to get to was who...
Yeah, no.
What your annual budget is and who covers...
For CAPSEF? Yeah, no.
Okay.
It's volunteer.
Thank you. Again,
okay.
I'm sorry. I missed that in the beginning.
No problem.
So there is no funding. You don't really have... It's funding is nominal each year. The cost of running... it's paid for by the dues. Got it. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here.
Okay. I think, looking around, I think we've gone way over today and we're about done. Thank you very much. Just a quick announcement. We are going to be adding another member our final member of the committee, Julie Swanson, is a special education advocate, and so she hopefully will be joining us at our next meeting, which will be held on April 10th, and we hope to have DDS and BRS back with us with written materials this time. And since they've already given their presentations, hopefully that'll be fairly quick. It's on transition services, you might recall. And perhaps, depending again on how that goes, we might be able to begin our discussion on how we want to analyze what's been brought to us thus far and how we want to choose to proceed in analyzing and discussing the things that we've learned as a group, so we can make some progress and kind of build on our learnings. That being said, Rep. Wood, you had a quick comment?
I just had, I think, a point of interest to mention in our conversation with the head of Windward School outside. He had mentioned and wanted to mention in here that the teachers at Windward are members of AFT. They are members of Teachers Union, although they do not have tenure. And I think that's a very good and interesting point to mention. It's one of 17 private schools, I guess, in the area that teachers are a member of a teachers union. So that's not true? Well,
no, it's different from certification.
Well, they are a member of AFT. I'm just entering that for the record. I mean, certainly the conversations will be ongoing, and I respect that. And on the Julie Swanson coming on, she is a parent advocate. I think we're very happy to add another parent voice to this debate and learning information. And she's come very, very highly regarded from a number of people, and we're delighted to welcome her at the next meeting.
All right. You gave the date we're meeting next. So with that, and you asked about questions being submitted. You did not. So the questions that we were talking about on the presenters prior, could please send us the any questions that you have to David. We can compile that list, and then we can schedule another time for them to come back with the, you know, with more presenters and the people that we need to have answer those specific questions, and we will move forward from there. If there's anything else that comes up between now and then, please feel free to email us and let us know what we can do. And we will see you on April 10th. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.